This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we find out what two universities are considering when it comes to a vacant block in downtown Springfield. We'll also update the effort to get a casino in Danville. It was 100 years ago, a race riot in Chicago left nearly 40 people dead. The author of a book about the incident will talk about what happened and why it's relevant today. Wet weather this spring has put most crops behind schedule.
It may look good from the road, but if you get into the middle of the field, it's very uneven. And then you're right, the stage of development for any of the late planted corn, July and August weather conditions are going to be pretty critical. And then there's also concern in some parts of the country about an early frost.
An update from the fields and what it might mean for your grocery bill. That and more coming up on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, some other states are responding to infectious disease outbreaks by doing away with religious exemptions for vaccines. Is Illinois ready to take that step? We'll have a report. Also, showcasing products made in Southern Illinois, and we'll look back at a dark chapter in Chicago history known as Red Summer. That and more ahead on Statewide. First up today, some farmers were lucky enough to get their crops in the ground this spring, despite the wet weather. Even those producers, though, are finding it a tough go this summer in Illinois. The latest numbers show less than half of corn and soybeans are in good to excellent condition. That's far below the normal progress. What does that mean for farmers and for consumers when it comes to food prices? Joining us for some answers is John Newton. He's the chief economist with the American Farm Bureau.
I think the latest numbers show what we've known really since March, when we had the flooding in the Midwest, then the delayed plantings, historic delays in plantings across parts of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, South Dakota. Any of the crops that were put in the ground were growing in some pretty tough conditions, and I think that's reflected in the good to excellent ratings across the country. Especially in the areas like Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio that have crop conditions that are well below their historical average.
And I believe I had seen, at least earlier, I assume the latest numbers show this as well, that we may be headed for the worst conditions since 2012?
Yeah, I think overall the U.S. corn crop's at 57% good to excellent. And the last time that we had, you know, condition ratings this low was the drought year of 2012. And while we're pretty far away from the drought year in terms of conditions ratings, back then we were about 30% good to excellent, today at 57. So we're better than 2012. But again, this is the worst that it has been since 2012.
And a lot of folks who don't farm, they probably remember the drought of 2012, and they may remember that prices went up then. Are we expecting the similar things to happen here because of this growing season?
I think we have. We've seen prices reached about $4.80 on new crop corn a few weeks ago. But then what happened is the acreage report that we got from USDA at the end of June, signaling 91.7 million acres planted or intended to be planted this year, really put a wrinkle in the markets. And we've been trying to find a price ever since then. We don't know what the yields are going to be. We don't know how many acres are planted. And we don't know how many acres are filed for prevent plant this year. And there's a number from USDA's Risk Management Agency that suggested anywhere between 12 and 15 million acres of prevent this year, which would be a record.
And by prevent, again, if you could explain what that means.
So any time the growing conditions are too adverse and a farmer is unable to get in the field and plant a crop, you're eligible to file a prevent plant claim with your crop insurance. And that provides you a portion of the revenue coverage for those growers that were unable to plant. And so many folks track that number because it provides some insight into how many acres were ultimately planted for grain harvesting.
When you're talking about prices, and you're looking, of course, nationally at the crop conditions across, of course, the Midwest and elsewhere, but here in Illinois, from what I've been seeing, we are even nearing the bottom of the Midwest and probably one of the worst in the country at this point.
Yeah, it's really concentrated there in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. And at one point this growing season, There was actually people saying that Indiana should file to be the sixth Great Lake because of how much rain we were getting across the country. So it's in pretty tough shape there in Illinois. I think as I counted last week, had about four million acres of corn and soybeans in poor, very poor condition. We haven't seen anything like that in quite a while.
Now, when I drive along the roads, I'm sure other people do as well, they see the corn here. The corn looks pretty green. In some places, it looks pretty tall, a lot better than it did during that drought year. Soybeans don't look so bad to me as well. But really, I guess it's about the development stage, right, and where things stand at this point of the season.
It is about the development stage. And in some places, it may look good from the road, but if you get into the middle of the field, it's very uneven in some of those wet spots. And then you're right, the stage of development for any of the late-planted corn, July and August weather conditions are going to be pretty critical. And then there's also concern in some parts of the country about an early frost this year as well, impacting the crop since it was planted so late.
You mentioned, of course, that you really knew what to expect going into this season or knew it was going to be a tough growing year. But has there been anything that surprised you as the numbers have been coming in?
But what happened is, we had the flooding in the Midwest and then just heavy rains, record rainfall in some cases, and they just never let up. It was relentless. Many growers didn't have an opportunity to get into the fields for quite some time. So you could see it, you know, occurring throughout the planting season. And so then when we get to start evaluating how the crop is growing and the stages of development, one would anticipate that it's in pretty tough conditions and likely to lead to a shorter crop this year.
You know, over the last several weeks, we've started to see the rain subside a bit, been a little bit more back to normal, some hot weather in July as well. Could this still turn into an okay year, better than maybe people anticipate even right now? Is there still like a best case scenario, a possibility?
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, going back to 2016, we had some pretty dry conditions that growing year. Many folks were worried that we were going to have, you know, a short crop. And we ultimately, what happened was we had fantastic growing conditions the rest of the year. And we ended up with a bumper crop in many areas. So I think these crops can bounce back. It, you know, July and August weather conditions are going to be critical for the yields. But I think what we do know is we didn't plant 91.7 million acres, or we're not going to harvest that many acres this year. So I think all eyes are going to be on the August crop report from USDA to help us right-size expectations for what we have on corn and soybeans.
For those people, again, who aren't farmers, aren't, you know, don't understand agriculture maybe to the same level certainly that you do and many of the people that grow these crops, what are they doing right now? Let's say, you know, concerns about the future and what prices are going to be in a few months. Are they sort of holding on to their storage right now and waiting to see if they can get a better price here in a few months?
Well, you know, not only are farmers raising a crop, but they have to be smart business people. And that means marketing a crop, trying to find the right times to sell a crop. And so when prices rose and you didn't know how high prices could go, many farmers likely held on to some of that. We saw the grain stocks report from the Department of Agriculture revealed that corn farmers had 7% more corn in storage on the farm this year relative to the prior year. So I think there's certainly some of that holding on and seeing where prices go.
And John, from a market perspective overall, you said you're watching for that August report to come, but what else are you looking out for here?
Well, I think just monitoring, you know, the weather, the growing conditions here, but also what's happening in South America. That's real important. You know, if they have a bumper crop there in South America, you know, that could lead to lower prices for U.S. producers that compete in that global market. So we're no longer the only game in town. There's a lot of folks that can grow corn and soybeans around the world. And so we're paying attention to what those farmers are facing as well.
And tariffs, I'm assuming the concern still over that as well?
Oh, without a doubt. I think, you know, we're going to get news this week on what the second round of trade aid payments are going to be, the county level payment rates that we're going to see. So we're continuing to monitor that. And then we've also got a farm bill that we passed in December of last year that we need to get stood up. Lots of things to monitor still in this farm economy. one of the things that a lot of folks ask is, are we going to see higher food prices as a result of this growing season? And I think it's far too early yet to tell, you know, what's going to happen to food prices. We know that a lot of the corn that's raised across the country is ultimately used to feed livestock. So I wouldn't jump the gun on saying, you know, retail prices are going to go up.
John Newton is the chief economist for the American Farm Bureau and joined us after the latest crop progress report was released. You can find details about that at our website at statewideshow.com. Well, the second annual Southern Illinois Made Expo is taking place this weekend in Marion. Jennifer Fuller with member station WSIU talked with Southern Illinois State Senator Dale Fowler about the event.
This is something that I've always been wanting to do, is to be able to showcase Southern Illinois made manufactured products. And actually, it all kind of transpired from when I went to the Delta Regional Authority, Delta Leadership Institute back in 2008. And to graduate the institute, we had to make a presentation. And my presentation was actually Southern Illinois-made products. I actually showcased Dinger Bats out of Ridgeway, which is an incredible Southern Illinois-made story, as my presentation. And then that's always kind of been in my mind. And then when I had an opportunity and I became a member of the General Assembly, I thought, you know what, I would love to be able to try to get all these incredible products, or as many as possible, under one roof. And we did that last year. We had 130 booths of products at the Pavilion in Marion. And this year, we actually increased it to 165 because we sold out early last year. And we have a lot more sponsors this year. And again, 100% of all proceeds are going to go to our Veterans Honor Flight.
You know, I looked at the list and Dinger Bats will be there. It's a really broad variety of products, services, manufacturing. How do you get all of those to kind of come together in something like this?
And if I might add, destinations as well. We really want to showcase the tourism opportunities we have in Southern Illinois as well. What we do is my team, last year we just started making phone calls. We started sending out letters, inviting these companies, doing a lot of research on the companies that were there. As you mentioned, we partnered with the Southern Illinois Regional Chambers of Commerce as our partner, which is a great partner to shop Southern Illinois. And you know, it just came together. And when you do something for the first time, you just really don't know how it's gonna work out. And we had over 2,000 people that came through the doors, and it was just incredible. And a lot of when the vendors filled out the surveys at the end of the expo, one of their first questions is how quickly can I sign up for next year? So we knew we hit a grand slam.
When you look at all the opportunities from manufacturing, tourism, as you mentioned, the service industries and others that are located here in Southern Illinois, what more does this region need to really get that economic boost that I know so many leaders like yourself are looking for?
Well, what we have to continue to do, and what I really work hard in trying to do, is really capitalizing on the resources that we currently have to offer. With all these incredible companies, with the confluence of the Mississippi and the Ohio, with all of our tourism destinations and our rivers, our lakes, our roads, you know, and our interstates, and just really showcase positively, you know, what we have to offer. And then when we do that, and really create the awareness and really market Southern Illinois for the beauty and the opportunity that it has, then good things come from that.
How important in your mind is it, too, that people in this region know what's created, what's made in this region?
Well, there's a lot of incredible products that we don't know about. And, you know, just like last year when we had 130 booths, you know, walking around anywhere from a barbecue sauce to all the way to Crown Line boats, as an example, and everything in between. And it gave people an opportunity to see these products, and people would come up, wow, I didn't know this was here. I didn't know they employed this many people. And a lot of these companies were able to network with the other companies that were there. So now some of these companies are selling the other companies' products. There's been nationwide contracts established for the Southern Illinois Made Expo from last year. And it's just been great. And to be able to have these under one roof and really showcase what they have to offer. And on our website, simate.org, all the vendors that are registered, their website is linked to our website. And so if people that are there or are curious about some of the products we have, they can actually go to the simate.org and search the registered vendors and go to their website and look at their products, order their products, go to their store, and hopefully shop Southern Illinois.
And as you said, the proceeds from the Southern Illinois Made Expo, all the proceeds go to Veterans Honor Flight of Southern Illinois. Am I right?
That's correct. Last year, you know, again, not knowing what to expect, you know, I thought, gosh, if we could raise $10,000 for Honor Flight, wouldn't that be amazing? We raised just under $30,000. And this year, we have a tremendous amount more sponsors this year that stepped up. We have sponsors that may not necessarily be a Southern Illinois Made product. They may you know, reside in Southern Illinois, but, you know, if they become sponsors, then they have the full rights to come to, you know, and set up a booth and sponsor the event. And we have a lot more sponsors this year, and a really great incentive we have this year for people to really come as well, not necessarily just to see all these incredible products, but also what we can do in support of our veterans.
State Senator Dale Fowler talking with Jennifer Fuller from member station WSIU. Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed into law a bill allowing some SNAP recipients to use their benefits at restaurants. Advocates say they will begin seeking participating businesses. Those advocates include Nolan Downies with the Shriver Center on Poverty Law. He says he believes the program will be a huge plus to the SNAP recipients who are covered in the program, the elderly, homeless, and people who have a disability. Currently, the state of Arizona and many urban counties in California have similar programs. Hot food services at grocery stores is included in the Illinois legislation. And while that measure did have broad support, some raised concerns about higher restaurant costs that could mean SNAP recipients running out of benefits sooner. Up next, could two universities be joining forces in downtown Springfield? That story's on the way. Stay with us for more of Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. Still to come, the debate over religious exemptions for vaccines. Will Illinois follow the lead of some other states and do away with those? We'll have a report. We'll also get an update on efforts to bring a casino to Danville. But next, each week this summer, artists and bands have performed in a vacant lot in downtown Springfield known as the Y Block. And now new plans are taking shape for the city-owned land just north of the governor's mansion. Daisy Contreras has more.
Ashley Murray of Springfield brought her toddler, Maya Nicole, out to watch 30 Dozen Brass Band, a group from New Orleans.
I loved it. I loved it. Great energy. I'm usually here every Thursday, so this one, amazing. It just seems like a lot more people are coming out.
We're on the south end of the block, where hundreds of people gather for a weekly Thursday concert. The series is funded with a $25,000 grant from the Levitt Foundation and other local sponsors.
It's great for families, friends to get together and just kind of relax, especially after work.
The series has included world-renowned musical acts like merengue band Oro Solido and ska band The Escatolites. The last performance is scheduled for next week. Lisa Clement Stott is executive director of Downtown Springfield, Inc., the nonprofit in charge of bringing the shows to town. She says the series was an opportunity to get people talking about the block.
To make the conversation a more positive growth type of conversation than kind of the bickering that we've been having over the block, and to attract diverse audiences to the block, so to bring neighborhoods together that don't usually intermingle.
The block has stood empty since the former YWCA building was torn down in 2017. Proposals have ranged from a full block development of apartments, retail space, and parking, to a movie theater and restaurants. During his term, former Governor Bruce Rauner lobbied for an open space with a park, playground, and amphitheater, though that eventually fell through when he lost re-election. Two problems have persisted: the lack of agreement and the lack of money. But now consensus is building around another idea for the Y Block.
I think people realize the importance of the activated space with the Levitt concert series happening. And everybody, for decades, we wanted a university presence downtown.
Last week, Springfield Mayor Jim Langfelder filed an ordinance proposing that part of the Y Block be left for green space and the other part home to a University of Illinois Springfield downtown campus, which would include Innovate Springfield, the university's business incubator. The ordinance suggests funding would come from two sources, the Discovery Partners Institute led by the University of Illinois system and from the state's $45 billion capital plan. But just how much money those two will bring is still unclear. State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from Bunker Hill, says he has always supported university presence. His last suggestion was for Southern Illinois University to establish a satellite law school downtown. But he says he leaves the final decisions to city and university leaders.
I think the time's come for us to move this forward as much as we can, given the fact that I think we have all the pieces together.
Menar says even if this collaboration doesn't happen on the Y Block, the universities should still look for space downtown. A final design is needed to estimate just how much money will be needed. Menar says the design and buy-in from university and city officials could help build support among state leaders for capital funding. Ashley Murray, who has made her trek to the Y Block every Thursday with her daughter Maya Nicole, says she'd like the block to stay green.
So when you come out here and there's live entertainment, there's food, there's people, there's just a sense of community out here. I think to keep it a park and allow people to showcase their talents, I think this would be a great idea.
Still, Clement Stott says there's enough room for both.
I know that the universities value how close they would be to the Capitol, as well as it being seen from the governor's mansion windows. And then also there would still be plenty of space for a community gathering space like we have been building through the Levitt program.
At its meeting last week, Southern Illinois University's Board of Trustees voiced support for a law school campus, potentially in collaboration with UIS in downtown Springfield. Meanwhile, UIS Chancellor Susan Cook, in a statement, called a new building on the Y Block a tremendous next step for collaboration with SIU School of Medicine, the city, and others. Still, the biggest challenge is getting all the parties on the same page. Legislators, both universities, city leaders, and the community. I'm Daisy Contreras.
Springfield is the only city in the state to run its own coal-fired power plant. Now its public utility, known as City Water Light and Power, may close most of its coal plant. And as Mary Hansen reports, the closure makes for a complicated economic picture for the city of 115,000 residents.
Michael Cassidy takes a break from his trucking job at a gas station off I-55.
And then start work roughly around 5:30, quarter to 6. Drive up to Williamsville, get a load of coal, take it to CWLP, and then just back and forth all day.
CWLP is City Water, Light, and Power, Springfield's public electricity provider. Cassidy hauls coal from the mine in Williamsville to the plant on Lake Springfield, about 16 miles away.
All day long, just back and forth. A little boring, yes.
Springfield officials are considering a plan to close 3 of its 4 coal generators. A report on CWLP's future found that the cost to run them is more than what the utility can sell the electricity for on the wholesale market. And the generators require costly updates over the next few years. The Energy Authority's report also recommended more renewable energy, either by building solar and wind farms or by buying electricity at set prices from other companies. The move has Cassidy worried about the future.
There's about 20... CWLP dedicated drivers that would, I guess, be put out of work or have to go do something else.
Then there are the 300 jobs at the mine and the 180 jobs at the plant, though CWLP officials say not all would be at risk.
Anytime there's job loss, those dollars that those employees are earning cease to circulate in the local economy.
That's Chris Hembro, president and CEO of the Greater Springfield Chamber of Commerce. Still, what a coal plant closure might mean for jobs and businesses is more complicated. Hembro says commercial customers in Springfield, so not you and me paying our monthly utility bill, but the hospitals, manufacturers, restaurants, and state buildings, pay more than what they would in surrounding communities. Hembro says that slows business growth and expansion.
Because rates are so high, so therefore it goes directly to the business's bottom line, dollars that they could invest in other employees therefore growth, dollars they could invest in capital investment on their physical plant.
The Chamber commissioned a separate study last year that found commercial customers were paying 30% to 100% more than they would if they bought from Ameren, the next closest electricity provider. CWLP officials acknowledge rates are higher, but disagree with the specific numbers. The study also suggests that businesses are subsidizing residential customers, paying more so families can pay less.
My father always said that we used to have the cheapest electricity in the area because we had our own power plant. Now, unfortunately, it looks like we're the opposite.
That's Adam Solomon. He's the chief operating officer and president of Solomon Colors, a manufacturing company on the north end of Springfield.
So actually, this building that we're standing in right now is from the old power plant from the early 1900s of the city of Springfield that we are now repurposing for our own manufacturing purposes.
Solomon Colors makes specialty colored concrete mixes and equipment, and they're one of the larger electricity users in the city. The firm that did the rate study also offered a model to compare electricity prices. If Solomon was just outside of Springfield, they would pay around $127,000 less every year than they do now. Solomon says that matters because the company is partly employee-owned.
Well, we're an ESOP company. The more we make, it helps the company ourselves, and it helps the 100 employees that we have in this plant.
Hembro with the Chamber and Solomon say they want Springfield to address rates with the utility's long-term plan. Doug Brown, the chief engineer for CWLP, says that's possible. He doesn't dispute the commercial ratepayers pay more. He says the way to correct that is to follow the Energy Authority's recommendations, shuttering the coal generators and striking up deals with other electricity providers to buy power. Once that's done,
we were wanting to do a basic cost of service study for all of our rates and see where things can be realigned.
The city council would have to approve the new rates. But Brown says the whole rate restructuring process might not start for a year. For now, Cassidy, the truck driver, says he's taking a wait-and-see approach.
In the meantime, just haul the coal. Just keep it moving. Yeah, that way CWLP can keep the lights on.
I'm Mary Hansen, Illinois Newsroom.
This is Statewide. After years of trying, the East Central Illinois town of Danville now has the state's permission to host a casino, thanks to Illinois' new gambling expansion law. The city and a development firm are looking for an operator to run the casino, which would be built in Danville's Southgate Industrial Park area near the Indiana border. Danville's Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. talked about the process with Jim Meadows. Williams says potential casino operators have a week to send in their proposals.
Well, we had seven entities submit intents to reply, and they have until next Wednesday, July 31st, to submit their proposals.
But at the same time, you're working on a pretty tight deadline in the gaming expansion law. You have to get an application in by the end of October?
October 28th. So we have 96 days left, in fact.
What do you think the project size and scope will be?
I think that will be largely determined by the operators, and we should know that once we receive their applications. But I am guessing that, you know, we can have a maximum of up to 2,000 positions. It's my expectation that we'll have something around the 1,000 to 1,400 position range.
And when we talk about positions, those are gambling slots, gambling machines at the casino?
That is correct, yes, sir.
What are your hopes of the economic impact of a casino, whether it's jobs, taxes, other development?
Our expectation is that we would hopefully have, at least 400 to 600 new jobs. I know at one point they projected us to have at least $6 million or so in revenue a year. I'm not sure if we'll hit that anymore, but I think we could receive certainly upwards of $4 million a year.
And at the same time that you're making plans for a casino in Danville, I understand there are plans for a casino in Terre Haute, Indiana as well, that voters there will see a referendum on the ballot in November on the question. Considering that the idea of a Danville casino has been the draw in customers from Indiana, what do you think the impact will be of having a Terre Haute casino as well?
I think that's truly uncertain. The good news is they're at least an hour and some change away from us. We will be further along in the process than they are. So I think it will certainly impact us some, but I think not in a drastic way, hopefully.
So what sort of timetable are we looking at now for this development to go ahead, starting with the deadline that you have to send something into the state? what would you hope to have happen with the casino and when?
I would hope that within 2 years at most that we would have a casino open and fully operating. Hopefully subsequent development to support that. You know, we've been in need of restaurants out there. We have over 500 hotel rooms just in that corridor alone and no restaurants, so to speak, to support them.
That's Danville's Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. talking with Jim Meadows about efforts to open a casino in Danville. Kids across Illinois will be heading to school next month, and for parents, that means checking off supply lists and, in some cases, getting their kids vaccinated. Not everyone believes in that second one, though, which is why states like Illinois offer families exemptions for religious reasons. Just last month, New York joined a handful of states to ban religious exemptions, citing a large spike in measles cases. Though it hasn't happened yet in Illinois, lawmakers across the country are mulling whether or not to do the same. For Illinois Issues this week, our reporter Sam Dunklaw took a look at whether Illinois could or should end religious exemptions for vaccines.
To understand why religious exemptions are a big deal in the public health realm, you have to understand what just happened in New York State.
Once declared eradicated in the United States, measles outbreaks are rattling regions of the country again this year.
There have been 588 cases of the measles in New York City since last October.
There have been 255 confirmed cases of measles in Rockland County since the beginning of June.
So measles cases were popping up all over the place. They seemed to be stemming from a few communities near New York City where families were refusing to vaccinate their kids for religious reasons. It's something a lot of states allow parents to do, and parents of some 26,000 kids across New York State did just that last school year. The problem is, a lot of those kids were getting sick. It seemed like the New York State legislature should act, but what to do? Well, here's what they did.
An aggressive move in Albany. Governor Cuomo is eliminating religious exemptions for vaccines for school children.
That's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Here he is.
I understand freedom of religion. We all do. We respect it. I've heard the anti-vaxxers theory, but I believe both are overwhelmed by the public health risk.
New York was just the latest state to do this. Maine joined the group earlier this year that includes California, Mississippi, and West Virginia. Diane Peterson with the Immunization Action Coalition says nearly all of them had a preventable disease outbreak.
It led many states to strengthen their process for getting a non-medical exemption. But what that has done in many instances is just pushed parents from maybe a personal exemption to the religious exemption.
Peterson says people all over the country have been claiming religious exemptions after they've talked to somebody who opposes vaccinations, a so-called anti-vaxxer. They claim there are a lot of reasons not to get them.
Claims such as vaccines might cause autism, or too many harmful ingredients in the vaccine can lead to problems.
Claims, by the way, that have been disproven by science. Nonetheless, Peterson says, as states have gotten tougher on what exemptions to allow, a religious one is often a parent's only option. She says that's led to abuse. Now to the big question. Where does Illinois find itself in all of this? The state only allows religious exemptions to vaccines. Parents have to fill out a form, have their doctor sign it, and submit it to school administrators for approval. Illinois Public Health Director Ngazi Ezike says it's there for a reason.
We just want to make sure that people have understood what they may be refusing and maybe the risks of refusing and the benefits of immunization.
19,000 Illinois school kids used religious exemptions for vaccines last year, a 46% jump from years past. Meanwhile, 9 people in the state have come down with measles so far this year. While it's not a large number, it's the most since 2015. To drive that number down, Ezike says her team is looking at, quote, all the available options, which might include doing away with the religious argument for opting out. Which leads us to another question. Should Illinois do that? Here's Diane Peterson's take.
We need to come up with better immunization policy that does not allow for children to have these other exemptions.
And here's Barbara Lowe Fisher. She runs the National Vaccine Information Center, which advocates for what it calls informed consent.
We believe that people should be allowed to have all the information and make a voluntary decision without being punished for the decision that they make.
So far, Illinois lawmakers have avoided making a change. But what the state is doing right now is more telling. The public health department got a $3 million funding boost for vaccine outreach, and the state is subsidizing vaccines for low-income kids, something it had stopped doing. For Illinois to go beyond, it might take a situation like what happened in New York, a public health emergency. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
Find more of our story at the website statewideshow.com. Stay with us for more of Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 100 years ago it happened. We'll look back at a race riot in Chicago. More on Red Summer, still to come on Statewide. Immigration is the hot-button issue right now in the nation, and yet quietly, hundreds of such immigrants are still becoming citizens in a process that has taken, some of them, decades. Central Illinois gained 100 new U.S. citizens recently, and Dana Vollmer reports on the naturalization ceremony that took place in Peoria.
It was standing room only as family, friends, and supporters watched 88 Central Illinoisans take the oath of allegiance and officially become American citizens. Collectively, they represent 32 home countries, but many have lived in the U.S. for decades, and the journey to citizenship has been a long one. Mauricio Sadikoff is originally from Brazil. He's lived in the U.S. for 22 years.
It takes a long time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money and just bureaucracy. One time I had to leave a company I was working in legally because the employment authorization I had to be renewed within a four-month period, but it took them 6 months to get me the renewal.
Sadikoff lost his job because of the delay and had to wait to reapply until the work visa finally came through. He says his experience is not uncommon.
It's just a lot of hoops that we have to jump through. It's not an easy process to become an American. I don't know that it should be easy, but it probably shouldn't be this hard.
In order to become a U.S. citizen, a person must have their green card for at least 5 years. They also have to read, write, and speak basic English and be determined to be a person of good moral character. Then there's another 10 steps before the naturalization ceremony. Genesis Regalo Buendia is a volunteer coordinator with the Immigration Project, a nonprofit that provides affordable legal services to immigrants in central and southern Illinois. She says a lot of people get stuck on step one, getting a green card in the first place.
The line in order to apply and get a green card, to just apply for it, not even to get it, is for some countries over 100 years.
Regalo Buendia herself just became a citizen that day. Her parents brought her to the United States from the Philippines on a work visa. They had to wait 10 years for their green card applications to be processed, and then another 5 years to apply for citizenship.
The U.S., my home for most of my life, is now my actual home on paper. It's unfortunate that there are other people trying to get in our position that cannot call this home the same despite being there for even longer than me.
People like Arti Subramanian, who came to the U.S. from India in 2002 and watched her citizenship application hang in limbo from the Bush administration on through the Trump administration.
It's getting harder day by day. I hear people who are waiting behind us for the filing, they are hearing more horror stories than us.
When the honorees crossed the stage in the basement of the Peoria Public Library, they gained a host of new rights. They can register to vote, apply for a passport to travel freely out of the country, avoid the hassle of extra paperwork when applying for jobs or colleges, and they have a better chance of keeping their families together. Subramanian says there's another benefit.
Honestly speaking, it's a pride to say that I am a citizen of America.
U.S. District Judge James Shadid officiated the ceremony, in which he administered the same oath and the same certificate of citizenship his grandparents received after emigrating from Lebanon a century ago.
1919, they arrived here. My grandpa became a citizen in 1930.
Shadid said the event was a reminder of the opportunity he's had because of the decision they made. In his remarks, Shadid pointed out the divisiveness of immigration politics and criticized the unnecessary degrading of people. Sadikoff from Brazil says he's received nothing but support from his community.
But it is really weird to have a president that essentially tries to make me less of an American now that I'm going to get naturalized than somebody that just happened to be born here.
And now Sadikoff says he finally has the power to do something about it.
Now I get to have a political say, so I don't think that it is a positive thing to try to create two classes of citizenship. I think if you're a citizen, you're a citizen, and you should be treated as such.
With their certificate and a small American flag in hand, newly minted citizens return to what is finally, officially, their home. I'm Dana Vollmer.
This Saturday marks the 100th anniversary of a deadly race riot in Chicago that left nearly 40 people dead. The riot in late July of 1919 is documented in a book, and the author, Claire Hartfield, hopes her book, A Few Red Drops, will give a new awareness to an event that has been forgotten by many. She spoke with Brian O'Keefe.
The date was July 27, 1919, a day that would forever change the life of John Turner Harris and cause the whole city of Chicago to rethink where it had been and where it was headed. As is often the case just before catastrophe strikes, that Chicago summer Sunday morning was like any other, carrying no hint of the trouble ahead. Except that it was hot, the unbearable humid kind of hot that sits heavy on the chest and covers the skin with a glistening film of sweat before the day has a chance to get started. The air in 14-year-old John's bedroom in his family's home in the city's Black Belt was thick with the smell of animal blood that drifted east from the city's stockyards a few miles away. By the height of the day, temperatures would soar to 96 degrees, 14 degrees above normal, and this heat had been building for days.
That's Chicago-based author and historian Claire Hartfield reading from A Few Red Drops. It recounts the violent 1919 race riot in Chicago. She traced the nightmarish events to an incident that happened when then 14-year-old John Harris and four other boys sought relief from the heat in the cool water of Lake Michigan.
In Chicago, segregation was not a legal issue. Beaches were open, parks were open, restaurants were open to everyone. The reality of it is that everybody knows, you know, blacks don't go here, they don't go there. And there is still some of that today, I think, although it's much more subtle. But in any event, so the boys started out at what was called the Black Beach, which was about a half a mile from the White Beach, and floated out into the water and were just playing, and they didn't notice that they had slipped over that invisible line. In Chicago, under the law, most places were open to both blacks and whites. Children attended school together, and adults rode streetcars together. Under the law, blacks and whites could choose to eat in the same restaurants and get tickets to shows in the same theaters. Even so, many places were segregated, with the races separated by an invisible line. The beaches were like that. The boys knew, everybody knew. Blacks frequented the beach at 26th Street. Whites swam at the beach on 29th Street. That in itself, I don't think, would have been the blow-up. But at this, simultaneously on the White Beach, two black couples came and just decided to make it a beach day for themselves. And that was a statement, I think. Now, in looking at the history, I can't definitively say what was in the minds of those couples. But certainly within the context of this new, we can come and go and do whatever we want, that was the implication of it. So the whites on the beach, who, this was their beach, some of them were not happy about it, and they began throwing stones at the black couples. The black couples left for a little bit, came back with more blacks. So you see these tensions building up. Meanwhile, one white guy sees the kids floating over and starts to throw stones at them and hits one of them in the head, and he drowns. And so there you have an incident which could have been tragic but small, blow up into something big because these things came together. The final piece of the beach scene, which I think might resonate a little bit with today, is that everybody could see this white guy who had stoned the kids. And so they identified him to a white policeman on the beach, and the white policeman refused to arrest him. And so that just became a powder keg, and it went boom. 1919 was actually called Red Summer, because there were tens and twenties of riots around the country that summer. And they all really stemmed from some particular incidents back then that really just set off a series of events. After that, there was a little tension for a while, but then in the 20s, things settled down. Of course, then there was the war. And then, of course, in the 50s, things were relatively quiet, but they started to percolate again. Then you erupt again in the 60s and 70s. You have a downswing again, and now things are coming to a head again. So I think there are cycles in history that you can see, and that wasn't the first one necessarily, but it was certainly a big one, that cycle, around 1920.
For Hartfield, there was an even more personal connection to the story of the Red Summer. It was something she heard directly from her grandmother.
When I was younger, she told me of how she had been a young woman herself and had just moved from New Orleans up to Chicago. And she got herself an apartment in the Black community and a job at a factory in the industrial community. And she loved life here. And then one hot summer day in 1919, she was boarded the streetcar at work to come home. And as they got closer and closer to the Black community, she looked out her window and she saw these mobs of young men, Black and white, throwing stones at each other, fighting in the streets, you know, really kind of rushing the streetcar. And the streetcar driver was scared and so went straight to the end of the line and let everybody out there. And she was far from home and had to walk back home through all of these mobs. So it was something that stuck with her and she, you know, was really, really scared. So she made it home safely. But she told me this as one of her stories of Chicago.
The memory of that story from her childhood came to the forefront for Hartfield last summer as she again saw racially charged demonstrations and violence in cities around the country.
So my whole career has been in education, and I've always had a passion for young people, children and teenagers and, you know, young adults is what I would say. So I wanted to write something in an area for them that hasn't really been written about, but that's relevant to today because they know what's going on. It's not that they don't know what's going on, but it's sometimes hard to have a context for it. And my hope is that by reading this, it will help them to kind of sift through their own lives. And I'm hopeful too that the adults in their lives will also read it and talk to them about it, whether it's parents or teachers or other mentors that they have, and help them sift through the issues and then also encourage them to be active and not paralyzed by what's going on today, but encourage them, say, let's think of some ways that you can make a difference. I think that's really important. And if they start young, by the time they do replace us, they will have the tools, I think, to really try to make a difference in the world. A lot of the same hopes and fears that immigrants today are feeling in terms of moving resonated back then. So, you know, nobody wants to up and leave your home, all your things, all your friends. But at the same time, there's this hope of a better future in the move. And I think it was that kind of yin and yang that was present there.
The reason I kind of laid that groundwork is I wonder if this, well, I was about to say clearly race-based. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it offers some lessons about this tension that we're dealing with now that is not necessarily race-based, but immigrant-based.
Right. And I think it is. I think that people have a fear of change, and particularly those people who have a lot to lose or think they have a lot to lose. So they are afraid of change. They're afraid of what new people coming into their space may do to them. Well, I saw the parallels myself. I tried to mostly present the facts on both sides because I believe that the way people learn is through knowing the facts and then drawing their own inferences. So I don't think I was too heavy-handed in trying to say, this is what happened then, this is what's going on now.
But that's exactly why I asked the question, because I wonder, do you feel like you have to make sure people see there's a like, do you feel like you need to be walking around with a sign that says there's a parallel here?
Right. There are some people who've given me feedback and read it. And actually they're the ones who come to me and say the initial reaction is, wow, I never knew this happened. And this has so many contemporary parallels. So I don't even have to bring it up. So I think my experience is anyway, that people will see it. I'm hopeful that in teaching institutions that they can use it as a tool.
Even though many people don't know the story of Chicago's 1919 race riot, Hartfield's research into the events and the aftermath found that it was, at least for a time, a transformational event in the city's history.
One of the things that they did in the aftermath of this is they had a perfect opportunity to point fingers and say, this was you. And there was a little bit of that in mentioning some of the white gangs that were really a heavy part of this. But they put together a commission of 6 Blacks and 6 whites to really dive into what happened here and to give some recommendations about going forward. It's a 650-page document. And it goes into every reason that you could possibly think of. But most importantly, it really says we are all part of this, not just the people who were immediately in the riot, but all of us in the city, the media, the politicians, you know, everyday people, church, all of those. And then it calls upon people to come together and unite.
Brian O'Keefe talking with the author Claire Hartfield. Her book, A Few Red Drops, takes a look at the deadly race riot in Chicago 100 years ago. That wraps up another episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again next week at this time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. All of our episodes are located at statewideshow.com. Our podcast can be found through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.